Right, now, this is the very, very, very first live podcast show at Latitude, so well done everyone for turning out. You are witnessing history in the making. Yes! Cheer yourselves! You have earned it! Yes, wonderful. And we are kicking off with Spectator Live Table Talk, a show which explores people's lives through the love of food. And so without further ado, everyone start clapping, please, for the very, very first podcast at Latitude. Welcome to the stage, guys.
Hello, can everyone hear
can
us?
Can you hear us? Yeah.
She's brought her kitchen timer because she's a cook and she doesn't want to overrun.
I don't want to overrun.
Burn anything.
Okay, now I've got my kitchen timer. No one look at it.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us. It's so nice to see everyone here. I'm Lara Prendergast. I'm the food and drink editor for Spectator Live.
And I'm Olivia Potts. I am Spectator Live's vintage chef.
And this is our podcast, which started a year ago, called Table Talk.
And tonight we are delighted to be joined by Tracy McLeod.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here at the first ever podcast from Latitude Festival.
It's momentous. As we say, it's history in the making. So we're going to hear lots about Tracy's life through food, but just a very brief introduction. Tracy is a journalist, broadcaster, and award-winning restaurant critic, as well as a MasterChef judge. Tracy, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Olivia.
Tracy, you grew up in Ipswich, not all that far from here. Can you tell us what food was like when you were a child?
Yes, I'm a local girl. This is the equivalent of that scene in Yesterday where the young singer-songwriter plays at Latitude and he looks out into the audience and he sees three people that he knows. This is my kind of homecoming debut. I'm a local person, although there are more than three people here, I'm glad to say. Thank you for coming. Yes, I grew up in Ipswich, but my parents were both quite deracinated. They had both kind of lived very turbulent and sort of fractured lives. And my father had done national service in Malaya. My mum was born in India of a mixed Anglo-Indian background, and she had come to England via Malaya at Indian independence, and they met in London, and neither of them had family really. They had family, but they weren't part of our lives particularly. And so they sort of invented themselves. They were like modern people, and the food that we grew up with was sort of anything that was modern. So my mum would read something in a recipe in a magazine and she would cook it. So she didn't really, she hadn't never learned how to cook. So she sort of taught herself from cooking things from magazines. So she might try and make Peking duck for a dinner party, which involved, I remember, a wire coat hanger and a hairdryer, you know, hanging for sort of 24 hours, blowing it. But a lot of the things that we ate were really what we would now think of as junk food or fast food, but we just thought were the most amazing modern conveniences. So Smash, Wonder Mash, you know, powdered potato, yes, bring it on. You know, we were very early to get a freezer and things like frozen orange juice or frozen Arctic roll and things like that. It just seemed miraculous. We were heavily into our boil-in-the-bag fish, our Vesta, you know, beef risottos and curries, tinned chunky chicken from Marks and Spencer's, all these things which, you know, now we think of as the sort of, you know, shortcuts and cheats and not things that you should feed your children, but which to us just seemed fantastic.
And were there ever any dishes that you particularly craved or would come home from school and ask for?
I think the Vesta option was probably better, and I hope my mum isn't listening to this. She's not really of the podcasting generation. Probably better than her cooking, which was basically pork chops. And it was a lot of pork chops and lamb chops were eaten in the 60s and 70s. It's pretty much all I remember us eating. We certainly didn't have pasta. We didn't have anything spicy because my father had a stomach ulcer, so we couldn't have onions or garlic. So I don't really remember loving the food at home, but I really loved the food at school, weirdly. So I went to a girls' school in Ipswich, and the food that we had was so good that I literally can remember girls would be queuing to get to the table first, so that if a pie was put down and there was a particularly big slice, someone would run to the table, lick their finger, and put it into the biggest slice so that they could they could sort of, you know, guarantee it for themselves. The food was really good. Stews, pies, sort of jam roly-poly, that sort of classic school food. But, I mean, I don't know if there's anyone else here who went to the same school as I did, Ipswich High School, but they may be able to corroborate. It was really, really good food.
So it hasn't put you off nursery food now as an adult? You still like a jam roly-poly or a spotted dick? Or
I love a pie, a pudding, anything like that. love that sort of food.
And did you learn to cook when you were a child? I mean, were you at your mother's hip learning how to hairdry a Peking duck or not?
My mother didn't really cook that much. It was the sort of most basic sort of cooking, and not the kind of cooking where you stand next to someone and watch them do it. There wasn't a lot of cake making and baking and that sort of thing. So I sort of learnt a bit like she did, sort of from recipe books and magazines and that sort of thing. Yeah, we did. I remember making dumplings with her quite a bit. That was one thing that we did do together. But I was, when I turned about 14, I went into the classic teenage surliness. So I barely spoke to her for about 4 years. And my last memory of cooking with her is rather a sad one, where I was so surly making these dumplings with her that she just upended the whole bowl. And in my memory, they clung to me like burrs and fell off one by one onto the floor. And we both started laughing. But she remembers it, that she just threw them on the floor and said, "Well, if you don't want to help, go away." Anyway, we've picked up now. We get on well now.
And after school, you went off to Durham. Did you, I mean, what was food like there? Did you learn to cook more at Durham?
I learned to cook a little bit at Durham, and I was trying to remember my food memories from university, and they barely register. I think I was too busy doing other things to cook or eat an awful lot. I seem to have a sort of slightly binary memory of it's either sort of pies and pasties from the local bakeries or chips, or whole food. You know, that there was it was sort of the tail end of the 70s, and there was still quite a big hippie feeling around campuses, you know, and so you'd go and you'd get your stuff from the Whole Food shop that was run by the local hippie collective, and buy loads of beans and then soak them for days, and then invite all your friends around for an enormous sort of bean chili. Red kidney beans were probably the main thing that we ate. But anyone who could cook was a sort of miraculous person, and everyone would congregate around them. And I did went out with someone who had a complete collection of Marks and Spencer's cookery books. You know, those, I don't know if you remember
That's
them.
They very were kind sophisticated of sophisticated for a student.
They were kind of paperbacks, kind of glossy paperbacks, and they were really good little books. I don't know who wrote them. And he used to have he used to cook rather sophisticated things like chicken with grapes and things like that. And I mean, I went out with him for about 5 years. I completely unsuitable person, really, but just because he had these cookery books, I thought, well, he's a keeper.
And then you, as a young adult, moved to London.
Then I moved to London from Durham, and was lucky enough to arrive just at the time when it was just sort of the tail end of the gracious dining era in London, and those sort of famous Italian restaurants like Meridiana were still on the go. And I was taken to Le Caprice, which, when it had just reopened by Corbin and King a couple of years earlier, again by another boyfriend. And it was very, very gracious and very different from anything that I'd ever experienced. Because eating out, you know, when we were younger in Ipswich, it was basically Burnie Inn, steak and chips, prawn cocktail, Black Forest gatto. That
Sounds
was the
great.
Height of sophistication, you know. So to go to these places which serve such fabulous food, and also, you know, start to eat Indian food and Chinese food and all of those, it was a real education. I had worked a little bit in restaurants and pubs. I kept myself going through, you know, the latter years of school and university by working mainly in places around here. I worked at the Oldborough Yacht Club down the road, manning the bar for 2 summers, and it was a bit of an eye-opener. I'd never met such incredible, exotic people as the people that went to the Oldborough Yacht Club. I was behind the bar one day, and a young chap came in, and he said, do you have cake? And I said, yes, you have to go to the tea counter around the corner. And he said, no, cake and cola. Never met anyone like that in Ipswich.
And you started doing lots of radio. And what was the diet of a sort of young radio broadcaster like at that stage?
Well, my first jobs were very much television behind the scenes jobs. And the best one that I had, probably the best job I ever had, was I did quite a few years on Wogan, the TV show, where I was a researcher. So I used to have to take celebrities out and about. So I had to take Blake Carrington from Dynasty, you're too young to remember, to Ladies' Day at Ascot. I went to Dallas to look after Sue Ellen and Victoria Principal, Linda Gray and Victoria Principal, and you know, they took me out to a restaurant in Dallas. So I got quite an eating education from kind of being behind the scenes in television. And I went to tea at Brown's with Peter Cushing. These kind of slightly legendary people now, you know, it was like, again, it was the sort of the tail end of that sort of almost wartime era of show business.
And was it intimidating going out for those sorts of meals?
It must have been intimidating for a young, fresh-faced girl from Ipswich. but it was also an education. I learned how to kind of fake it in all sorts of restaurant situations, you know, tea at the Ritz and things like that. I learned how to sort of bluff my way through a menu and pretend to be sophisticated. And I went from that to working on Food and Drink, the programme, in its very early incarnation. And then from that, I mean, all the places I worked in television were gastronomic deserts. I worked in Shepherd's Bush, where there literally wasn't a decent restaurant, and Canary Wharf. But I actually worked in Canary Wharf, the warehouse, before they knocked it down and built the Canary Wharf Tower. And there was nowhere to eat around there. The nearest place to get anything to eat, you know, there was quite a lot of pubs that you didn't really do food. We used to have to get sort of bagels brought in from Whitechapel by one of the runners on a moped. It seems extraordinary to think of it now that Shepherd's Bush and, you know, Canary Wharf are both huge teeming restaurant, you know, destinations. But you asked me about radio. Yeah, so I did TV for a few years, and I also had a radio show, and everything that has happened serendipitously. One thing led to another. I don't think I've ever applied for any of these things, but, you know, working backstage on a television show, I then ended up being front of house, and I presented probably the most 80s show, which was called Network 7, which was the first youth show, which was produced by Janet Street Porter. That was the one I did at Canary Wharf. And then things did get quite 80s, and we used to sort of go to places like Joe Allen, the Soho Brasserie, go for these big meals after the show. The show was a live show, Sunday lunchtime, and we'd all go out and have these big feasts afterwards in these very glamorous restaurants, Fred's Club and the Limelight and things like that. So that was it was a real 80s type of life at that time. Well, obviously, because it was the 80s.
And you say that things have sort of happened serendipitously. Your path to restaurant critic was a slightly unusual one. Would that be fair?
Yes, I suppose it was. I mean, I don't think there is a kind of any received career path to becoming a restaurant critic. Well, there wasn't in those days, because there was only about 7 or 8 of them. And mostly it's a job that's given to the cleverest, funniest male writer on the newspaper who wants to go out and get lots of meals on an expense account. And, you know, that was always the classic tradition. There were some brilliant writers who also knew an awful lot about food, like Jonathan Meads and A.A. Gill, who were the two kind of twin gods, and John Lanchester, when I started on The Independent. But my route in was that sort of towards the end of the 90s, after my TV career had finished, I was sort of pretty much knocking around and London, single, and Helen Fielding and I and another friend of ours called Sharon Maguire used to get up to lots of things together. Helen was a restaurant critic, so we would go with her to the restaurants that she was reviewing for The Independent on Sunday, and we became sort of characters, Shazza and me and Helen, and we would go to places and make jokes, and we would be included in the reviews and in Helen's columns, which obviously became Bridget Jones's Diary. So those three women in Bridget Jones's Diary are kind of loosely based on me, Helen, and Sharon mucking about. And some of it, the actual columns in The Independent got quite close to things. Like sometimes we'd do something and then the next week it would be in Helen's column, very thinly disguised, and it got a little bit hairy sometimes. But 1 week Helen couldn't do her column. She took a break, I think just when Bridget Jones was starting to get very successful. And because they knew who I was, because I'd presented an arts programme on the BBC, The Late Show, they gave me the chance to, she suggested I did it. I did it for 1 week for The Independent on Sunday. And The Independent spotted it and asked me to join permanently as their one of their three restaurant critics. And I did it for 20 years. It was the longest job I ever had, and it was completely serendipitous, and it was absolutely fantastic.
And what do you think makes a good restaurant critic?
Well, I think every critic has got a different superpower. I think some people are brilliant at evoking comedy from the experience. I think Giles Corran is brilliant at that. You know, I'm in awe of the way that he can make of such a funny read. But often it's not necessarily for the people that are interested in going to the restaurant. It's much more about entertaining the readership. People like Marina O'Loughlin and Jay Rayner are brilliant at writing about the food. Faye Mashler brings that whole historical knowledge of 40 years of, you know, writing about restaurants, which is so amazing. I think if I had a sort of superpower, it was, well, I didn't have a superpower. If I had one thing that I was better at, it was evoking the kind of social experience of the restaurant. I always kind of tried to go to places that I really wanted to go to, and I always tried to take people that would like that experience. I never went to kind of knock a place down. I always went in hope that it would be good. And I think I was quite good at sort of capturing the atmosphere of the restaurant so that people could decide. It's not just about the food. For me, you know, the food is one third of the equation. But if the room doesn't work for you and it isn't comfortable, and if the service isn't good, and if the whole mood of the place and the people who are there are not your people, to me it doesn't work as a restaurant. I'm always much more excited about eating somewhere where I think I might bump into someone I know than, you know, going to a city where I don't know anyone. You know, it just becomes about the food, doesn't it? And I like the theatre of the restaurant, and I try to convey that as much as I could.
When you go to places which you're not reviewing, are you led by other restaurant critics, or do you just go wherever?
Well, I sort of think of myself as a recovering restaurant addict. I stopped doing the column a couple of years ago when The Independent went online. And up to that point, it was a kind of frenzy, really, of, and I'm sure both of you, being food lovers, feel it as well, that pressure to always go to a new place. So you never felt you wanted to return anywhere. People would say, what's your favourite restaurant? And I'd always say, the next one I'm going to. And there's so many fantastic openings. You'd feel like it's kind of frenzy as your to-do list grew longer and longer. Literally, restaurants would close in 6 months and you still hadn't had a chance to go to. I mean, I did have the experience once of reviewing a restaurant in the first month of it opening, and it had actually closed before my review came out, which was a bit unfortunate.
I mean, do you feel a responsibility as a critic? Because obviously you sort of have the power to make a restaurant close if people aren't going to it. I mean, did that kind of weigh on your mind?
I think it's a responsibility rather than a power. I think if you went around feeling that you were powerful, and I think there's probably a few restaurant critics, mention no names, that do, you would perhaps be a little bit more brutal. I think, you know, you have to realise that people's hopes and dreams and money and experience and, you know, so much love and passion goes into nearly every restaurant opening. And you have to try and give them the benefit of trying to understand what it is that they're trying to do and where they're falling short, rather than just slashing and burning.
And do you have a favourite all-time restaurant?
Well, I would have said the next one, that, but it's that classic Cheers bar thing of where you want to go where somebody knows your name. You know, you want to go where you'll get a friendly welcome and they know what you like. So, you know, we've got a local restaurant. We're lucky enough to have a local restaurant that's just opened at the end of the street I live on in London, which is the latest Corbin and King restaurant. It's called Soutine. And it's a lovely French evocation of a really classic French restaurant. It's only been there about 6 weeks, and already it seems like it's been there 60 years. And that's my favourite restaurant at the moment because it's so great to have somewhere lovely to eat in the neighbourhood.
Your first and last review for The Independent was of a restaurant called Momo in Mayfair. Had it changed a lot when you revisited it?
It was exactly the same. Neither of us had changed a bit in 20 years. Neither myself, Mac, nor Momo had changed a bit. I mean, I wonder if the audience is hearing this drumming at home. Yeah, I mean, it seems to be getting louder. I mean, we should paint the scene.
Can you all hear? Okay. That's good. Okay. That's fine. Yes, it's sort of gearing up in intensity, so I'm sorry for that. So as well as your written restaurant criticism, many people will know you as a MasterChef judge. I'm not going to ask you to recount all the many, many dishes you've had on MasterChef, but I am going to ask you which was the worst one you were ever served.
Well, I wouldn't like to say worst, but I mean, some of them are challenging. I'm not actually a judge on MasterChef.
You're a critic.
You know, only the judges judge, which is, you know, we don't actually know who's gone through at the end of the day when we've done one of our critics round days. But what can be disappointing is quite often you're served four two-course meals, and each of the chefs, and this tends to be more true of the professionals than the amateurs, have done some variation of a bit of lamb or duck and a sauce and some sort of potato thing or a vegetable thing, and it's just not very imaginative. You think you've got one shot here to blow our minds, and you've done a really kind of quite boring thing. And you know, it's also challenging when you have to go from lamb to chocolate pot to halibut back to chocolate pot to beef. By the end of the day, you're feeling like, can't eat another piece of lamb. So it's lovely when you get something that's a bit different. And some amazing things have sprung to mind. But you asked me about terrible things. I mean, the most difficult to eat was a vegetarian dish that was cooked about, you know, in one of the amateur rounds by a lovely lady called Sarah, I think she was. And it was a Vietnamese spring roll in a rice paper wrapper. And she'd obviously hadn't tested the strength of the chili, the raw chili that she put in. So I had, you know, one mouthful and I got that thing where you're involuntarily start hiccuping. And not just hiccuping, but full nose running, dewdrop from nose, eyes, you know, sweating. And that's not good when you're being filmed in high definition. And when they intercut it, you know, Greg Wallace, because Greg and I have got so much in common, Greg Wallace also was hiccuping like mad. And it doesn't go away. It stays, you know, for the rest of the day, there was like a little aftershock. So
Drink all those chocolate pots.
Yes, chocolate pots. Please bring on the chocolate pot. I also remember Wayne Sleeps Turbot, which was so rare that it was just a kind of pink blubber on a kind of rack of bone. That wasn't a highlight.
Speaking of celebrities and memorable moments, you re-encountered your old friend Janet Street-Porter.
Oh, yes, Janet. I did. My old friend Janet, who was my producer on Network 7, my flatmate at one stage, thereby hangs another tale. And she cooked a very Janet dish, which I think was roadkill pheasant, which she claimed to have picked off the road near her house in Yorkshire and brought in. But the producers just changed it to something like foraged, because they didn't feel that roadkill was quite the thing that the BBC One 8 o'clock audience would.
How was it?
It was good. Janet's a very good cook. I mean, she really is. She's an excellent cook, yeah, and had spent in the course of her many marriages, I think, had learnt many different varieties of cooking. When I lived with her, she was coming out of a major cooking phase, and she had a huge amount of cookery equipment, you know, like a real professional cook's battery of equipment. But she was going out with the lead singer of Zig Zig Sputnik at the time, so it didn't really come in handy. I think he could have possibly put some colander down the front of his trousers for theatrical effect.
There's a TV show that the audience perhaps might not be quite as familiar with that you were involved in called Kitchen Criminals. Can you tell us what that was about?
I thought you were going to mention the programme I presented with Michael Gove called Stab in the Dark.
A similar concept?
Kitchen Criminals was a thing I presented with another Spectator hero, Toby Young. I think I was a judge on that, but I don't remember too much about it. They were people that couldn't cook that were taught to cook, and then we had to... I can't remember, actually. I don't think it really caught on. It was certainly hasn't kept going for as sturdily as MasterChef has.
And when it comes to your own cooking, are you a good cook?
Well, my son's here. Am I a good cook? Yes.
That was a thumbs up.
David, my older son, is a very good eater and used to come with me a lot on restaurant reviews right from when he was little. But my younger son claims that everything I cook is disgusting because it's not simple. Like, he likes fish fingers, burgers, pizza. So when his dad cooks, that's his idea of a great feast. It's sort of going back to my childhood, really. But when I cook and I do something like, you know, chicken satay with peanut sauce, he comes running into the kitchen. He goes, "Oh God, it's mum's food. This looks absolutely disgusting." Anything that's complicated or that involves cooking is disgusting. But no, I do love to cook. And we've got a weekend kind of cottage near here in Suffolk. And there's a whole group of friends that we've all holidayed together. And to a certain extent, there's a sort of element of we've all learnt to cook together, or we all cook together, and there's a lot of communal cooking, and we go through sort of food phases. So this year seems to be the year of the tray bake, very much based on the sort of the green roasting tin.
Yes, yes.
Every year.
That's right, we all, many year.
Yeah. Yes. We all, exactly. And we all fall under the influence, you know, so there were the Ottolenghi years, the Nigella years, now we're in the, you know, very much the vegan and vegetarian, because a lot of people's kids are vegans and vegetarians, so we're all learning to do interesting things with a green roasting tin.
And what about travel? I mean, have you travelled a lot? Has that influenced your cooking?
I have travelled a lot. I've been to Japan I went to Japan to interview Rai Kuda. Those were the days.
Don't get those briefs anymore, do you?
No. So yeah, I've travelled quite a bit for work, and yeah, obviously love to eat. And I mean, I was an au pair. That's really where I learned to cook, was I was an au pair between school and university. And I went to France for 9 months. And the old Vesta beef risotto and Wonder Mash were not going to get me very far. And the food was so fantastic. You realise just how a French housewife, as opposed to my mum, who was a British housewife, French housewives probably spent about 70% of the day shopping, cooking, preparing food for their families, and I did it all at her side, and I learnt how to eat, and I learnt how to cook, and things like sort of braised endives, that when I ate them on day one, I thought, this is like eating rust. It's like eating a rusty sponge. It's disgusting. By the end of the 9 months, I was absolutely sort of craving this, you know, delicious sort of cuisine bourgeois that I ate there. And things like raclette, you know, delicious grilled cheese, those kind of things.
Where in France were you au pair?
I was in a place called Valence, which is quite near to Lyon.
Right.
So that was a really good way to learn. And the weird thing was that after coming back from sort of 9 months of the best eating that I'd done, I ate so much, I'd lost quite a bit of weight, you know, just because I was eating, I suppose, the sort of classic, you know, no junk food French way.
And what I want to ask you about whether you have a sweet tooth, because you are the daughter of a dentist. Is
oh,
that
yes.
Right? Were I you am. Allowed a sweet tooth when you were little? I mean, we've talked about jam roly polies, but was that verboten just at school?
We weren't allowed sweets. We were allowed chocolate, right. But we weren't allowed anything that you sucked. You might edit that out.
We weren't.
My dad's practice was very near two big factories. The Ransoms factory was at the end of our road, and he saw kids that he'd done their teeth all the way through their school days go and get jobs, and after 6 months their teeth would just have crumbled because they were sucking kind of mints and all day. And he was passionate about not letting us have any kind of boiled sweets or anything like that. So we were allowed sweets once a week. But it was tended to be things like Yorkie bars and curly whirlies and things like that.
You once posted a photo of a deep fried Mars bar on your Instagram. I mean, is that?
I did have a deep fried Mars bar. I think that might have been at someone's birthday outing. I think it was rather delicious.
And just finally, I mean, dinner parties. Do you enjoy hosting dinner parties? Do you regularly host them?
Dinner parties are kind of hellish for me. I'm not good at dinner parties. I get quite stressed, and I've never had a house or flat which has had a good entertaining space. So I've always had a separate kitchen. So that idea of being away in the kitchen and someone coming to talk to you while you're trying to cook, I'm really bad at that. I just go to pieces and I just want to say, get out, I'm trying to cook. That's not what anyone wants from a hostess. I'm a bit more relaxed about it now. But I much prefer going to dinner parties than giving them.
I only asked because obviously the famous blue soup in Bridget Jones. I just wondered whether that had any basis in reality or
that definitely
you knew
did.
What the story
that was
of.
All. That was Helen. You know, Helen is was quite a enthusiastic and slapstick hostess, and it didn't help. You know, the only rule. Nigel Slater had a good rule for dinner parties, which is never cook anything for a dinner party that you haven't already cooked several times at home. But the other rule would be, don't have a glass of wine until you're sitting at the table, because that's often been my downfall. And, you know, you end up with no pudding or worse, some sort of, you know, bandage on your finger because you've enthusiastically joined in with the drinking when everyone arrives.
I know Lara said final question, but I have to ask because you... all your years in restaurant criticism and travel, what's your desert island meal? If no limits, no holds bars, no holds barred, what would you have?
Well, I love oysters, so I'd probably start with half a dozen oysters. And then, that's such a hard question.
Sorry.
I love Thai food. So some really delicious kind of like green papaya salad with some spicy fish or something like that, with maybe coconut rice. I mean, I love the food. There's this sort of new breed of Thai food, which is kind of very, you know, kind of fused with that kind of guerrilla style. You know, the sort of young British cooks that are doing this kind of amped up version of Thai food. And I love that kind of thing. I'm not a great purist. I like it with everything turned up to 11, you know, really, really hot. And then afterwards, jam roly-poly pudding. I don't think I'd have room for it after my oysters and my fiery Thai banquet, but yes, it's a slightly odd.
It's a good ending.
It wouldn't work as three courses on MasterChef.
Whatever you like.
And what about, I mean, as Bridget Jones' basis, what's your drink?
Well, Campari and soda, obvs.
Tracy, thank you so much for joining this episode of Table Talk from Latitude Festival. And if you've enjoyed it, we have all of our other episodes on Spectator Radio. You can just find it wherever you get your podcasts from.
So yeah, you can find other podcasts. I'm just going to do a quick plug. Other podcasts with interviewing Prue Leith, Tom Parker Bowles, Bryony Gordon, Cressida Bonus. Lots of different people talking about their lives through food. So please do... review, rate and subscribe. It helps other people find the podcast. Thank you so much, audience, and thank you, Tracy. Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.